Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sutris. Today we step away from the Word Balloon Lounge and step into the Word Balloon University. Now very soon I'll be spinning off episodes of Word Balloon University into its own podcast and own feed, but for now, to get you guys into the habit of listening, I wanted to present this here. I had the pleasure of moderating a couple panels at the Summit City Comic Con last month, and this seemed to be a good opportunity to launch Word Balloon University properly. A good variety of webcomics are represented on this panel. There's Andrew Frazier, the creator of Bridget's Belly, Mike Schwartz, creator of Oceanverse, Eisner-nominated Dave Wachter, co-creator of The Guns of Shadow Valley, and Katie Cook from the Star Wars Clone Wars webcomic, and her new creator-owned webcomic, Gronk, A Monster's Tale. You're going to hear all about how they make their comics, how they promote their comics. It's a good tutorial for people who might be interested in starting their own webcomic, and also they talk about the challenges of the current marketplace. Today's episode is brought to you by the sponsors of the Summit City Comic Con. That's Discount Comic Book Service and InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they guarantee savings of up to 35% off and no shipping on orders of over $50. Now, they have a great selection of trade paperbacks, hardbacks, absolute editions, omnibus editions, all at reduced prices. But currently, there's a great sale going on for the books under the Project Superpowers umbrella. Now, those are all the great public domain characters from Nader and Hillman Comics of the 1940s, featuring such characters as Lev Gleason's Daredevil, The Black Terror, Masquerade, so many others. And they've got great savings on all of the trade paperbacks from Project Superpowers, 50% off. For example, you can get the first Project Superpowers trade paperback. That's available for just $9.99. Chapter 2's trade paperback, $4.99. The Black Terror first trade, $7.49. Daredevil is now called the Death-Defying Devil for the trade paperbacks, just $7.49. And a great book from Phil Hester, Masquerade, also priced at $7.49. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com. The place to be if you want your pull box online, because they have great savings of up to 40 to 70% off a lot of your favorite monthly issues. So check them out for their details. Discount Comic Book Service at dcbservice.com and InStock Trades at instocktrades.com. Well, thanks for coming, guys. Welcome to the Webcomics panel. My name is John Sutris. I host a podcast called Word Balloon, and I'm very pleased to meet some of these people for the first time. And I forgive me, because I am new to some webcomics as well, so I will have them, if it's all right, folks, to introduce yourselves and mention the webcomics that you're most known for. So please, begin.
My name is Andrew Frazier. I do a webcomic called Bridget's Belly.
Very cool. Talk about Bridget's Belly. What's it about?
It's a Rubenesque comedy about a romantic girl. It's a anthropomorphic for animal characters. It's a story about this girl named Bridget Bouvry who ends up getting pregnant and has to deal with raising her children and getting through to school and dealing with her parents being absent.
Gotcha. Mike?
Hi, I'm Michael Schwartz. I do a webcomic called Oceanverse. It updates every Monday and Thursday. And the basic premise is there's a kind of a pulp hero character, an older guy named Clayton Hemmings, and he has a submarine called the Red Herring, and he assembles a crew and goes under the sea and has lots of adventures. Broad premise, I mean, there's time travel and sea creatures, giant sea creatures, and just goes from there. It's somewhat of a throwback to kind of old 40s adventure strips. That's what I wanted to do with that.
It's got a real Disney 2000 Leagues Under the Sea kind of feel to it, too, I think.
With no pet seal or musical numbers.
Yeah, exactly. No Kirk Douglas singing Whale of a Tale, exactly. So
that's what it's missing.
You know.
Hi. My name's Dave Wachter. I do a webcomic called The Guns of Shadow Valley at thegunsofshadowvalley.com. Updated every Tuesday. It's basically a long-form Western adventure with a little bit of a super-powered twist in there. Essentially, it's about sort of a... It's a Western at its core with the superhero element mixed in for each of the characters. So each of these characters in a posse has a special ability. And then we mix in a little sci-fi, a little steampunk, That's about it. It's a page a week, and it's sort of a long form storytelling of slowly unfolding large scale adventure.
My name is Katie Cook. I am probably best known for drawing the Star Wars webcomic for the Clone Wars on StarWars.com. But I have also recently started up my very own webcomic called Gronk, A Monster's Tale, which is an all-ages comic about a monster who really hates being a monster and kind of rejects that society and tries to live among the humans.
And you are tearing my heart out with that comic strip, I must say.
It updates every Friday, and Friday was very sad.
It was. Aww. And it's a girl monster, mm-hmm. which is awesome. And I think that's kind of novel. Mm-hmm. So, well, we've got a good diverse group of webcomic creators. And I'm assuming all of us are webcomic fans, obviously. I really think the last 10 years have been very interesting, and we're about to enter a new, very interesting decade as well, with some of the technological advancements with the iPad and things. But for all of you, and we'll just go right down the list, and we'll start with Katie and go down to Andrew. But was it really the ambition of eventually getting a newspaper strip or a comic book thing? The convenience of being able to do your own thing on the web.
My story is a little bit different, considering I started off doing the Star Wars webcomic, because that's not doing my own thing. That's doing something for a major corporation. But starting my own is not really even about exposure. It's about having a story to tell, and now you have a way to tell it without having to go through printing costs. And it's nice because you can have a readership, without the physical book. Eventually you aim to have that physical book, but right now, all of a sudden, you can put your strip online every single week, and people can follow it, and people can comment on it and give you feedback, and you don't need to, go to shows every single weekend and sell a book, which is what I like about it.
Dave, I remember when you were doing Scar Tissue back in the day, too, and you're and really watching the formation of the Guns of Shadow Valley and listening to your excitement about the project, and then obviously,
hanging out at the bar when I was talking about it.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. But also, as Katie just said, too, being able to sidestep the production costs of coming up with a physical book and being able to do it online.
Yeah. I got a little burnout on the self-publishing, both on the cost and just the effort to try to get it out there, finding a way to distribute it and things like that. We had come up with the Guns of Shadow Valley originally was designed to be a pitch for a comic to be taken to publishers, and it was, and we got a couple of publishers that were interested, but we just didn't like the kind of deals we were getting. We didn't like the kind of combining that with the creative restrictions that we had on it, especially for the small publishers, and what kind of they want a short series, they want to be able to have just a 3-4 issue series to start, so we just decided to take it to the web to be able to put it out in the kind of format we wanted, to be able to have chapters that needed to be the lengths they needed to be for the sake of the story. The idea being is to just go on the web and work it out creatively the way we wanted to, and be able to and then just try to build an audience and get it out there and get some exposure for the eventual going back to the publishers again to see if they'll pick it up for a graphic novel treatment at a full-length version when the first story comes to completion.
Mike?
Yeah, when you mentioned, John, about newspapers, that was the very initial idea, because looking at comic strips, I was looking back at the old ones from the 10s, 20s, 30s, and it's like, it appealed to me because all of those were long-form. There's Popeye stories that would go on for weeks, and Steve Canyon, and it wasn't, I was looking almost at this old stuff as something new that was not a gag-a-day, really simplified, dumbed-down comic that you see in newspapers today, and it really intrigued me, and so I wanted to try something like that, and pretty quickly I realized that, first of all, the newspapers probably wouldn't, want this strip. It doesn't fit in their criteria, and newspapers themselves are dwindling. They're getting rid of their comic section. It's just not feasible. And here you look at the web, which is something that's still growing. Like, especially with the iPad and stuff, it's like this, it's such an open frontier, and why not just do that? And it costs extra, or it costs nothing, rather, pretty much, and you can pretty much do whatever you want on it. There's no restriction, and I think we all pretty much have different formats of our strips, right? Mine's more of a traditional strip, and Dave's is big, colorful, and it just affords more creativity, I think. That's why I settled on that.
Talk about the format of your strip as well, Andrew. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I'm curious. What? How would you describe the pacing of your stories?
It started out as a strip, an attempt at a strip, and I liked the idea of an ongoing story. The original premise of the story of the series was. To be blunt, it was fan service for a select group of people. And when those stories kind of petered out quickly, I realized I had to do something more, and so I invested more into the character design. But recently, I've gotten frustrated. I mean, 6 years I've been doing the strip, and I'm frustrated with the limitations that the page, the strip, the format holds. And just recently, I've switched over to a full-page long-form story format. So it also fills up a comic book easier. It doesn't take 94 strips to fill out a 60-page comic as bonus material. So now I can just do, you know, each page is one strip. And I've noticed that it opens up a lot more for the artwork, and it opens a lot more for. What you can do on a page and storytelling too. You're not confined, restricted so much. So, Eisner felt the same way too.
And Katie, with the new strip, it seems like you're doing like half a page sometimes, as opposed to like, you know, the traditional kind of four boxes.
It is. It's a square format, which I've actually been drawing the Fraggle Rock comic book in, and David Peterson from Mouse Guard says that I stole from him. But I consider the fact that he and I are good buddies. I'm allowed. But I actually really enjoy drawing things in a square. I don't know what it is. There's an OCD part of me that's like, squares, they're perfect. So I just do a four-panel strip, but I do it much larger. That way I'm not confined to something that's this little rectangle. I can do something that's a little bit bigger and shows off my line work a little bit more. So
I was kind of concerned, and really wasn't thinking about the iPad until it was introduced, that, you know, I would think about digital comics and the way that, you know, they were starting to be geared towards smartphones. And really, you know, essentially it is the size of a comic panel. And at first I'm like, well, that's cool. But then I also was concerned and thought about some artists that really do beautiful panoramic shots, beautiful page splashes and stuff. And I'm like, you know, you're dealing with a baseball card. And I even forget which artist I was talking to who talked about how he had made his comic for a traditional book form, and he saw it on a digital comic, and he said the art was all smushed down. It was Gabriel Hardman. He was talking about Heathentown. And Gabe's a very classic kind of traditional illustrator, very classic kind of heroic style. And he said, you know, everything just became like an ink blot. I mean, it just got so small and tiny, it was ridiculous. Now with the pad essentially approximating the size of the comic page, it would seem that for all of you, it gives you guys a bigger canvas to play with. Mm-hmm. And you can really have your cake and eat it, too, in terms of really playing with the traditional comic page, but doing it in the digital form. And really, every page can be whatever you guys deem it to be.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, because things are going digital, your options are endless. You're not limited to drawing your page 11 by 17 just so later on you can get it printed at that size, because you can get things printed at any size now. So, yeah, doing things digitally is really opened up to, you know, I want to do something that's a scroll comic that is 52 inches long by 12 inches sure. high. Because, you know what, somewhere out there someone's going to be able to print that later on. But for now, you can have somebody sit there and scroll through the whole thing and read it. Because I have seen someone do that, and it was actually really cool. They did it once. But yeah, you're not limited anymore, which is great.
And I remember Scott McCloud talking about that in the, you know, few his understanding comic yeah. books mm-hmm. and stuff. I want to ask the audience, are you guys aspiring web comic creators? Are you just fans of web comics? How, you know, show of hands, who wants to do their own web comic? Because I'm sure
it's already working on my campaign.
And there, of course, it does, absolutely. Artists in Progress, congratulations. So that's great. So, I mean, we can't, so it's about half and half. So we can talk about, you know, what these guys do and lady to gather their audience, but also, you know, talk about the content as well. So you guys all mentioned, and lady, that you mind if I call it say guys instead of
you can say guys.
All right,
I'm one of them.
You can punch me later
all good.
If you want to. Okay, fine. But yeah, I gathering an audience. Let's go down the line and what did you all do to gather and promote the comic? Because as we know, the best thing and the worst thing about creating things for the internet is anyone can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you guys being the exception that, you know, you've actually come with some talent to the table, so that's good. But no, tell me, how do you gather an audience?
I guess I'll go first since I'm sitting right here.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the Star Wars webcomic, again, is a different story because I already have a built-in audience right there. You know, and I already have Star Wars promoting it. But my own webcomic, I was actually really concerned because it's like, oh, wait, I got to do this on my own now. And it actually just started last month. And I was really surprised because all I did is I put it, you know, on Twitter, I put it on my Facebook page, and I put it on my page. And it blew up from there. And on my very first strip, I had over 7,000 hits on the
Wonderful.
First day within the first 12 hours.
That's fantastic.
And I... I'm sorry! And, you know, I had a freak out moment and I was like, wait a minute, now what am I supposed to do? I have to do this every week now. Because then I got this big influx of emails saying, oh, we're so glad that you're doing something that's your own, because for so long I've been doing stuff for Star Wars and I've done a lot of licensed stuff for Marvel, I've done stuff for DC, and now I'm doing stuff for Jim Henson. I've never put out anything that's mine. So I have a fan base that was like, oh, you can do something that's yours? Great. But really, the best thing you can do is have a Facebook page, have a Twitter feed, have a blog, and, you know, promote those things constantly, and then use that to promote your own work. Because right now, I'm not running any ads for it. That's probably going to change eventually. But yeah, just telling people about it. And I know that Danielle Corsetto at another webcomics panel that I was on with her said that she made business cards for her site and left them at bars. Like,
well,
she would, like, yeah, she would just make business cards and then leave them in, you know, restrooms at restaurants and then in bars and, you know, anywhere where she thought, anywhere where she thought her audience was, she would leave stacks of business cards there.
Was it formatted like a comic panel? Did it have a little?
No, it was just a business card with a little image and then the website on it.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God, that's kind of brilliant in its own way, because I do a kids comic, so all I could think of is I need to do that so I can drop them off at libraries in the kids area. And so, but yeah.
I tried dropping mine in the ocean and it didn't really.
Yeah, well, you would think that's where your audience is, you know, Mike, so I would understand.
I had a really
Dave,
big
I know you and I were both Brian, both people that would hang out at Brian Bendis's message board.
Yeah.
And I know being a podcaster, that was a good way for me. And I know early on, before, you know, things got too crazy and that there were a million podcasts or whatever, at the time you could go to message boards directly and kind of gain a grassroots audience. And I know that's what I did. And I remember you doing similar things with Scar Tissue.
Yeah.
But tell us what's changed since.
It's basically just keeping up with the communities that you become a part of. Whether it's the being a fan yourself of other things and finding their message boards and getting on there and being part of those communities and joining in, and then when those communities see one of their own make something, and then they will go and check that kind of thing out. I think that's got to be one of the biggest things, because that, you know, it's like the message boards are a great place where anybody from any direction can come in and plop down and sit at the table and everybody talk. Whereas, you know, and then I think stuff like Twitter and Facebook kind of can spring out as a second step from there, because they sort of already got to know that, like, they got to sign up to follow you for those.
Sure.
But a message board, you're in the group, you know, in the group dynamic there, and then and you know, as you become a member of this group, then you'll be able to formulate people who will maybe then want to become your fan as they discover you're starting to do these things. And it's, you know, and then there's this fine balance. I think we were talking about one of the, maybe the CGS board or something like that recently, and there's this fine balance of when you start making your own things as to being part of the community versus just going onto message boards and just pimping yourself.
Right.
Because
right.
people will get a little, sure. they don't like it.
No,
because you know, they want somebody who's part of that community along with them. And I've known, I mean, I can be guilty of that too, because I get, you know, I'll have months at a time where I'm just so busy that the only time I'm on the message board is to say, you know, the next page is up. And people are like, well, we haven't seen you for a while. It's like, yeah, it's because I'm trying to work on that page, you know, or these get these pages up on time or else they don't come up every Tuesday. But, yeah, I mean, it's tough because there's so many, you know, like you said, anybody can do it, so there's going to be a lot of them, so you got to be able to find a way to build your community and stand out. I mean, you know, number one is having a quality product.
Right.
That's going to stand out in the webcomics world. It's something that looks like, you know, you've put thought into it, and that you've taken the time to really make something that's solid, and that you've really, that you look like you put effort into it. You know, because there's a lot of stuff out that just, you know, looks like, and sometimes it's supposed to look like it's done quickly, and that works. But sometimes it's clearly just sort of done, you know, with not a lot of effort involved.
And with you and Mike, and I want you to answer to this, having such specific genres that you're dealing with, Dave with Westerns and Mike, you with ocean, you know, adventure, but nautical, based on a nautical premise. Yeah, I mean, are there other avenues other than just webcomics? I mean, are there, you know, but really like a Jules Verne, but you know, really like an, I don't know if there's like a Jules Verne-ish kind of pulp geared towards, you know, oceanography kind of things, fan base that you can go to. The one example I've been using lately on podcasts is Tim Truman in the 90s couldn't get someone to publish a specific Western that he wanted to do. So he ended up making it himself. And this is, you know, early internet, so he didn't do it online, but he made a book and then he promoted it in Cowboy and Western Books. And he actually made money off of it because he went directly to that audience and said, here's a graphic novel about the stuff you love. And he sold a lot of books that way and did it all himself. So I don't know if you guys are afforded that kind of avenue. And
I haven't done that.
Write it down.
It's definitely something to consider. I think mine's more adventure enough where it's not about the ocean or about fish. It's more about the adventures they have. So I don't think I necessarily need to do that. But I could look into it because I was... Like Dave mentioned, message boards and cultivating the fan following that way. And in addition to that, what I found can gather an audience is using Project Wonderful for advertising. You can advertise, you can have ads on your site, but also you can advertise on other people's sites. And you can set up campaigns where Project Wonderful is kind of basing, picking sites for your ad to advertise on, based on your criteria you set. And sometimes you can strike gold and hit a website that has a lot of return from something you wouldn't even think about advertising on. And then after that, then you can specifically advertise on that site and kind of build up from there. I've had success on that. And also websites like StumbleUpon and Reddit, you can submit links to there, and especially Reddit. Submitting it to the comics, web comics, and sometimes just generally Reddit, you can get a lot of returns.
Yeah, you need
very
an extra 10,000 hits that day.
Yeah.
You can get it on 10, Reddit. Get it.
What? 10,000? That much?
You can get it in the top 5 or something.
Wow. Talk about Reddit, because I'm not aware of it. What is Reddit?
Yeah. You want to go for it?
Yeah, it's basically just a site where you can submit links. It's sort of like Dig, one of those
okay.
things. Okay. And they have
specifically for web
specific
comics.
Categories.
Yeah, categories.
Yeah,
you
great.
Yeah, you have the title, your link, and then there's categories. There's tons of them, but the successful ones I found is comics and web comics, and you can submit your link to both of them. And they definitely get a spike from that.
Yeah, people vote on it whether they like it or they don't. They can leave comments. The more comments, the more votes, the higher up in the listings, and you get in the top 10, you get thousands of more hits that day.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. StumbleUpon works the same way, but I think that's a little more successful if your strip is more self-contained to one strip, like a gag a day, because then if someone finds it and they like it, they read it, and they can send it on to someone else. With our strips that are more long-form storytelling, they can see like one piece of a 24-page story and not quite get it, But sometimes there's a return from that, but not as much as more singular strips, I think.
Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I started out with websites that are no longer existing. Basically, I started out with just posting pinups to a specific group to a specific page that catered to a certain audience. And basically, I just kind of built a following for the style of artwork that I do. And interjected the idea of doing a comic and just kind of built from that. And it's been kind of here and there, because generally the audience for furry is hit or miss. Either people get my comic or they go, oh, it's furry, well, I don't want to deal with that. So
But there are furry communities, and I mean, you know, what I mean? online that you do you target them? And
The problem though is a lot of them are kind of dwindling.
Oh, really?
They get a lot of backlash from the whole furry is a negative connotation. So I kind of see Bridget as a limited series. It's going to have an ending, and I'm going to move on to something different.
Do you have ideas of what kind of genre you want to do beyond? Really?
Yeah, steampunk.
Cool.
Definitely. Something steampunk.
Okay.
Clockbook steampunk sort of thing. I always want to keep with furry genre. I started reading furry comics back before the whole fursuiting thing started happening. So, you know, I don't really see that as an issue. I see guys like Art Spiegelman and Usagi Yojimbo, Stan Sakai.
Absolutely.
I see them as kind of the original furry, the original anthropomorphic, and
yep.
That's kind of, I want to get back to that sort of concept. So, and it's also difficult to go to a comic convention and just sort of try to promote yourself and go on to the panels that you're not quite sure if you're qualified to be on, but you're there anyway, it's a warm body.
No.
But, you know, just to get more people out there and more people to say, hey, give it a try.
Yeah.
I think the best compliment I've ever gotten about my comic was, no, really, it's a lot better than it looks.
Put that on a business card.
You mentioned the conventions, and that's a big thing since we're at a convention that I guess we haven't talked about. Is a great way to get out there and meet the people that you communicated with online, and it's also a great way to, you know, just get people out of the blue and get a lot of new people that way, because once they meet you, I think that makes a difference, is when you have that face-to-face or a handshake or you've talked to somebody, even if it's for a minute or a second, you know, if they know you as a person, I think they're going to be more likely to check into what you're doing. And also, I do another thing I do online and at the conventions too I do a lot of the artwork and commissions for people, and I think that's one way that I've been able to get my name out a little bit is not just, you know, like if you're an artist making your webcomic, then offering the art up in a personalized form of doing the commissions for folks, of requests that they do, opening your stuff up. If you don't have a lot of time, you can open up a window where you just take a few, or you do them as pre-orders for conventions or while at conventions. But I've noticed that's one way that I've been able to, at least especially recently, is to get more people another route to get people into what I'm doing. They'll notice that I do that art, and then they'll be like, I'll tell them about the webcomic that I do, and then maybe they'll come over and check that out too.
That's happened to me already today, because for the conventions I do little watercolor drawings of superhero as fish.
They're awesome.
Thank you. And people notice that right away, and they're like, wow, and the kids come up and take a look at it, and I also have little paper models of the submarine in the comic, and they can take that, they can look at the fish, and I said, oh yeah, that's the submarine in my webcomic. You have a webcomic? Like, yeah, and then it's, yeah, trying to find ways to promote yourself and your work where, even though it's at the table, but there's a lot to look at, there's a lot of things going on at the convention, but kind of get something to get their eye and then lead them toward the actual product of the webcomic or the comic. Like, what I brought here too is that every 48 strips I publish into a floppy comic 24-page comic through printed through Kablam, which is great for digital printing and on-demand printing. So just kind of print out what you need and bring to the shows. And that's a good way to get it in people's hands, because a lot of people don't read stuff on the web.
Right.
I mean, guilty as charged. it's just sometimes a hard thing to get into, and I'm assuming a lot of people actually still like to have stuff in their hand and read it, and that's why I think the iPad could be pretty good down the line, because it's digital, but you're still holding something tangible.
You can take it into the bathroom.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially with comic books. Absolutely.
Oh yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
Thank you for the mental.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I do the. I don't keep making issues, but I do like a preview issue. That's the first 18 pages, and I threw a couple sketch pages in the back. And what I'm trying to do is trying to hook people. They get it in their hands, and maybe somebody who doesn't necessarily read webcomics. I actually do get a lot of people who buy the book, and they're like, "Well, I don't usually read webcomics." I'm hoping that my story is strong enough that they'll want to get page 19, you know, and be like, "Well, then you can go online and get it for free, and you can get the next get up to 72 or whatever we're at so far." And hopefully hook them that way, and then maybe they'll get the collected edition again.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll read it three times. I'm sure people love to triple dip.
I'm kind of counting on it.
I've been handing out free ash cans.
Okay.
My comic, and it has a segment of the story that just kind of gives a good overview of what the whole story is about, and then a preview of bonus material that are in the comics. I'm a big fan of bonus material in comics, because if you can read it for free online, what's the incentive to buy a book? So I always do a little bonus material in comics just to get people hooked.
Katie, is your Star Wars stuff collected?
Actually, the first season of the Star Wars Clone Wars webcomic is coming out into trade in August. Oh. It will first be available at Celebration, where me and the four other artists and the author are going to be signing. So, yes.
Did you draw that one that's on sale at auction? Or there's some Star Wars Clone Wars?
Nope.
It's got that one. I never watched that one.
Okay. It's not just a movie, it's an entire series.
There's this thing called Star Wars.
And I kind of dig it.
I want to open it up to questions in the audience, because really they're here to talk to you as well. So, yeah, please, sir.
Yeah, so if you could speak to the experience of drawing for Lucasfilm, for Star Wars, and what kind of control they exert over that process, and what you are able to contribute to it.
It's the Empire. What's it like to work for
whatever
Empire?
George wants, George gets. But really, it's fun. I mean, I grew up, you know, a giant Star Wars fan, so what am I going to do, say no? But mostly they hand the script down like 4 days before it's due, because each issue tied into the episode, so it needed to be approved. And then there were 5 pages that I had to draw in color in a very, very short amount of time. Sometimes I got 2 weeks, sometimes I got 4 days. And then, of course, you send your pencils in, and they're like, that lightsaber doesn't look right. You send in your inks. Well, that doesn't look right. You know, it's his costume, his belt needs to look a little bit wider. And that's what it was at first, and now I have carte blanche to do whatever the heck I want.
Oh, great.
So I'm not controlled anymore. So basically I can just turn in a finished piece of artwork, which is nice.
This season's been less connected directly with what's going on in the weekly series. You know, the first season, it was kind of, you know, that point of view of someone just off screen, less so, I think, this season. What's going to happen in the next season?
Season 3 is going back to the same thing as season 1, where it's going to be tie-ins to each one, which I think is a better format for the Star Wars webcomic, mostly because I think they're really, you know, they were going for a really Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kind of thing for season 2, of two miscellaneous characters kind of watching everything from the outside, which for a kid's comic doesn't work as well, because they're two characters that you don't know. When you're working in licensing, you're going to find that, you know, as much as you want to create that next big DC or Marvel character, people aren't going to connect to it right away. And same thing with Star Wars. If you create a Star Wars character, and you're trying to focus on them instead of Ahsoka and Obi-Wan and Anakin, people aren't going to connect. So.
Sure.
For everyone, do you guys consider yourselves writers first, artists second, or like, do any of you guys collaborate with writers, or you know what I mean, like, how does that work with you guys in doing your comics?
Put on the list.
Someone else can start.
I don't know. I've sometimes written writer-artist on things when they say, well, what do you do? You're a writer-artist. Cartoonist, you know. But when you think of all the great cartoonists, everyone thinks of them as very literate people, like James Thurber. And, I can't think of any off the top of my mind right now, but it seems like it's the illustration is a shorthand to the writing. For me, that's kind of the way it is. Obviously, you know, my characters... I have sort of a Herzé approach to characters, so you know, my characters are anthropomorphized. They're just sort of there to draw the story along. So.
How do you work from a script? Do you pretty much start
with the script first?
Okay.
And then I think of blocking like acting. You know, where is the character on the stage? So I mean, that's kind of. And then another allude to Reisner, you know, with his way of blocking characters and stage thinking. As far as
I think for me, it flip flops between thinking in the writer mode and thinking in the artist mode. Because when I start out, like, okay, because I usually write things in a 24 strip block. So the first thing is coming up with a concept, and in my notebook, I just write kind of freeform out of my head, just keep going. Some things stay in, some get left out, some get used for another story. And then after that, then I go down a page and number 24, and then, like, for this one, this is going to happen, this was going to happen, this is going to happen. So I'm still writing, and that's one of my favorite parts, because then it's almost like a puzzle, because... Even though it's a pretty wide-open story format with 24 strips to tell something, and then he's like, oh, I got to hurry up and get this done to move this in here, and so you're kind of shifting things around to get it to work. And then after that, then I kind of do like thumbnails of strips, and they're incredibly loose. If I were to show them to you, and you can come by my booth and see my sketchbook, like, you wouldn't be able to tell what it is. Like, it's basically maybe like three lines and just a scribble, but it's enough for me to kind of get the energy and the page layout that I want, and then I kind of write in what they're going to say above their heads, scratch it out, do something else. So it's almost like it is slowly morphing into a strip and kind of morphing into the artist portion. And then after that, then it's when I transfer it and actually start drawing it. And that's actually the hardest part, I think. The whole parts before that, it's a lot of it's exciting to do. It's like the creative part of your brain's running, trying to come up with new ways to fit the panels in the same rectangle every single time. And then you got to draw it. It's like, oh man, that's when you're met with a blank page again after a while. And it's like, I just want to get this done so I can ink, because that's a little that's more fun. The penciling for me, more so now, because I find myself having less time to work on it. It's more excruciating. And it's like, let me just ink, because I'm finding I'm kind of leaving more for the inking process that way, and just get enough down. And plus, I letter everything by hand too. I don't do that in computer. So that's kind of the first thing I do, is get out the Ames lettering guide and make the lines and write everything in and use that as a design element in the strip, so that everything works together, and that if you see the original, it's a piece of art. That just kind of my throwback to the ways they used to do it and wanting to try and do it that way. And then, you know, later on, if I want to change up the format and maybe in color, then I might do a computer lettering. I'm not sure, but... The way it is now, everything is pretty much done by hand.
So just kind of a quick follow-up with that to you guys, too, is like, you know, I got a lot of friends who are musicians, and they write a song, and it's always like that. There's never one way to do it. There's never one way to create something, because, you know, sometimes you could maybe come up with the music first, and then that speaks to you, and the words come from that, or maybe sometimes you have a melody in your head. And the same thing, like, you guys, you know, draw something first, and like, oh, this is really cool. What's the story behind this? Or is it more... I mean, I know it's like it's never gonna be the same thing, but like, do you find yourself more like drawing it first or having the idea first, and you know?
Well, with me when I'm doing it, like some strips are very, they're almost like plot strips where you kind of, you know, sit down and have a big, the panel can be completely filled with words explaining what's going on, or someone has a monologue, and then there's some where it can be completely silent. And it's those where it's like, well, should I have them say something, or is it better left just alone, just let the story speak for itself? And it flip-flops between strip to strip. I don't know what everyone else...
Well, I'm a member of a team. There's three of us who work on it. It came from my original concept, which was a very broad idea. Basically a Western and then infusing superhero elements. I brought this to... My previous self-published project called Scar Tissue, I was just the artist. Sometimes I suggested scenes or changes, and I often did changes in panel layouts and number of panels and the pacing and things like that. But so I was working for this. I wanted a stronger hand in the writing. So I am working with my same partner, Jim Clark. He, at this point, we started off where we work out the plot together, just in meetings, what's going to happen overall and the overall arc, what the major themes of it are. And then we, you know, go keep getting narrower and narrower. Until we're working on chapter by chapter, and we sort of figure out what are the steps in the chapter. Then from that point on, I would take sort of our broad outline for the chapter, and I would go in and I would outline it basically action by action, what's happening each step in the chapter. And then I would give it to him. He would basically put that in a screenplay type format with dialogue. Then I would come in and I would rewrite a lot of that, and then he would argue with me about why I was wrong, and then I would argue with him, and then basically we kept arguing until we were arguing, you know, down to just a few words that we wanted to change in the dialogue. At this point right now, it's more I'm actually doing, I don't know if I'm just tired of the arguments, but I'm doing more of the scripting now. I mean, he has a lot of, not as much time to do a lot of the stuff. We still work on the plot together, but... It got to the point where as I was writing the outline and then he was adding dialogue and then I was scratching off a bunch of the dialogue and then we would argue about the dialogue. So now I'm doing a lot of the scripting and then we'll still go back and forth on it. From there on, then I do the art. And then the script will change again. And I often, because I also have a letterer, so then I'll put the page up, I'll upload the page to go to the letterer, and I'll be like, and here's another revision of the script for the next page because I've changed, again, the number of panels. I've changed again where the dialogue goes. I've eliminated a little more of dialogue. Once you see it visually, you realize that somebody needs to say something there. This beat doesn't work with that lettering. I got to get rid of that. I need a pause there. As to the first question, I consider myself an artist that works in two different mediums. You know, one is writing and one is the visual art. I was always, but I grew up being a visual artist, and I guess writing, this is actually my first sort of professional foray into writing. I've always done a lot of writing, but this is sort of my first time doing it on sort of, a professional level.
Don't write like me is the first advice I can give you, because normally it's, I started writing my comic Gronk 8 years ago. And it's just notebooks full of little bullet points and little doodles of what a gag could be. And I wrote a Fraggle Rock story, and that was the first time they actually made me write a script. And I kind of had this moment of like, oh, because I turned in my little page layout doodles with little arrows going, this is what they'll probably say. That doesn't work. So lately I have actually had to sit down and script things out because I wrote a story in the first Fraggle Rock issue. I have a 20-page story in another issue. And right now I'm trying to write a 4-issue series for something else that's kind of like, what? Because, again, I tried to turn in my, this is kind of what it could be. Don't you get it? And they're like, no, we need to see the actual script. It's not working. But one of the reasons I like doing things myself is because I can take those little bullet points where I know where I'm going to get eventually, and I can just work from that. Because I don't actually like having a script, because then all of a sudden it's like I feel like I need to follow it to the letter, especially with stuff like Lucasfilm, because that's what it's going to be. I can't really argue that. I'm looking for season 3. I'm actually going to write a few of the webisodes, which I'm kind of looking forward to. But they don't know my writing process yet, so we're going to figure that out. But right now, I work off of, like I said, bullet points and little doodles that look like potatoes, you know, with random dialogue bits. If I think of something clever, I will write it down. Otherwise, it's all up for grabs when I start lettering. Because then it's like, oh, I wonder what I should put down here. There, that's fine. So yeah, don't write like me.
Now that inspires another question, because, Katie, you say that you've got Lucas films mm-hmm. to go over your Star Wars stuff and mm-hmm. guide you. But for the, you know, on your own thing, and mm-hmm. also for all of you, it would seem to be able to grow. You do need some sort of editorial voice to kind of say, you know, you may want to try it a different way. Mm-hmm. To you know, really, there's the, you know, that is kind of the line, I think, that we're all looking for it, to improve. And, mm-hmm. and how do you guys approach that, you know, on your self-created stuff? I mean, who do you go to be that kind of voice of dissent and say, you may want to try it a little differently?
I'm really lucky in the fact that I have a really great core group of friends. Every week I have a drawing group with David Peterson from Mouse Guard, Jeremy Bastion, who draws a comic called Cursed Pirate Girl, and Jay Fosgate just recently entered the group, who does Dead Duck for Ape. And they are literally who I turn all my stuff around to and say, what am I doing wrong? And they will critique it. And, you know, and we do the same. And it's like a round robin thing of what are we working on this week? And we all just kind of shift around. And if I didn't have that for the past almost 3 years now, I would not have grown into the artist I am becoming. Especially David Peterson, because, one, he's been a big inspiration in getting me to do my own comics. But two, he's also really harsh. Like, he will sit there and go, no, you're not going to do that. That's wrong. That's bad. And it's like, oh, really? I already inked it. No, you're going to do that over. No, you're not going to put that out there. It's like, oh. But that's mine, is that I have, you know, a group of people that I really respect and admire that I get to see every single week. So.
Yeah, I think that's what I use Jim for.
Okay.
Because we argue a lot, and it's led to some, you know, I think one of the reasons we do work together as well as we do is that we've been working together for like 6 years now. We respect each other and each other's opinions, and we're also friends, and we know that we can tell each other the way it is,
yeah,
you know, without having to softball it over, you know, and without somebody getting their feelings hurt or what they like and they don't like. And it's been pretty tough, and we've all, you know, almost, I can't say come to blows, because he lives in San Diego and Californians don't fight. Can't fight, really. But I lived in Chicago for 15 years. But it's just that, you know, it's almost led to the complete disillusion of the working relationship before. But we've always been able to come back from that. And I think that's one of the reasons we're able to check each other, and we're able to really question each other's reasons for doing things and challenge each other on the decisions that we make. And I think we have... two very, he's just writer, so that's what he focuses on. And we have, when it comes to the scripting and everything, we have two different ways of what we like, you know, and the kind of things we like. So there's a tension there that I think helps us, you know, come out with a better product in the end.
When I finish penciling, or I ink it, when I finish penciling a 24 strip block, I show it to my wife, who has read comics, but she's not a huge fan. But so I'm able to get kind of an outsider approach to things, and with that, sometimes she'll find something that I didn't see, like, well, this doesn't make sense, or I'd probably get, I'm too invested in the material, and with her, I'm able to kind of like step back and say, oh yeah, that is not as clear as I thought it was. I need to add a word balloon here, or I need to change this around. And she's told me before that like she's a fan of the book, so it kind of like she wants to see it succeed and doesn't really know what's happening until I show it to her. And she's pointed out a few things many times. They're like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, thank you. And yeah, it helps to have that fresh pair of eyes that may not be as a comic reader eyes, but as someone who likes to read it, and you know, will kind of put me in place sometimes.
And my dad's 1972 electric eraser, which is the size of a Dremel tool and can take off a tattoo if you need it. So I was trained as a sculptor, basically. I went to college and I did sculpture, so I have this desire to go over, back and over anything I do. So I guess the editorial process is built in. If I don't like the way a scene is looking right away, I'll go back and I'll either erase it or I'll start over and I'll say, okay, well, this isn't working. This needs to do this. And, or let's try a different camera angle. And or if I'm writing something down, I'll say, okay, well, this fits into this story. Otherwise, it goes into a shoebox or a file box. And I've got about 6 file boxes of unusable story ideas. So it's kind of a give and take and push and pull for me. I just kind of carve things out.
Yeah, I think one of the most important pieces of advice I can ever give to somebody is that don't be too precious about your work. And I think that's one of the great things about webcomics is that you slap it up there on the web and you sort of get this instant feedback, and you start, you know, and you can always change something later if you need to. I mean, it's not stuck down in ink. I mean, it hasn't been printed. There's not 10,000 copies in everybody's hands. I mean, you can change it if you need to. I mean, that's not a problem. And if you're too in love with your line, or you're too in love with the page you just did, I mean, that can be a huge mistake. And you always have to be willing to throw any idea out. I mean, your best idea, especially with writing, with art, it can be tough too. And you got to think of it the same way: is that any panel, any page, any character you do, I mean, your the stuff you thought was your best stuff at the beginning, it's going to end up out of it. It's not going to be in it anymore. You know, yeah. When you're first coming up with, you're writing something, it's something with my process too, is, you know, I think of scenes and you're thinking of characters, thinking all this cool stuff in it, and the coolest things you think of, they're not going to end up being in there. I mean, they're just not going to end up for the, you know, working for the story you're doing, or some, or they don't work in the tone. Maybe you can use it in a different project, but be willing to throw everything away.
You had a question?
Yeah, when do webcomics become profitable, and when do you quit your day job?
I was wondering if someone asked that question.
If you are Scott Kurtz, Daniel Corsetto, or one of five other people that actually make money with them, you cannot go into making a webcomic saying, I'm going to make money and quit my job doing this, because it is not going to happen. Well, it's because, like, I was going to say, there's very few people, you know. I'm lucky enough that I do other comics outside of my webcomic, and that affords me to stay at home and draw, which is amazing. I mean, it's an amazing way to make a living. But right away, it won't happen. It's going to be something that you have to build towards, and it's really going to be a labor of love, because you really need to, you know, be determined. This is how I am going to make my living, and then you have to work your butt off. I mean, it might take you 2 years, it might take you 5 years, it might take you 10 years, it might take you 20 years. But eventually it could happen. There's a really great book that Scott Kurtz... How to Make Webcomics. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I met him at
If you have not bought that book, buy it. And the first thing it says is, do not go into webcomics to make money, because it is not going to happen. But, you know, where your money is going to come from is eventually when you put those into a trade and you can start selling it. But, you know, that's going to be a lot of self-publishing fees, so you got to spend money to make money. and then eventually, you know, being able to do merchandise off of your characters, which again is after you have a following that is willing to you know, buy those things. There's a really great philosophy for people that want to be basically internet-based artists, which is kind of what I consider myself, because my entire fan base I've got online. You need 1,000 true fans to keep yourself going as an artist. 1,000 people that every time you put something out there, they will buy it. And when you find those 1,000 true fans, you can support yourself as an artist. Not your 50 fans and your mom, not your 50 friends, your mom and your aunt and your cousin Lou, but 1,000 true fans that you have no idea who they are, that if you put up a trade of your book, they will buy it.
Yeah, that's the old indie music adage. Mm-hmm. You've got 1,000 people who always come to your concerts, yeah. always buy your album.
Yeah.
And you've got it.
Yeah. Same premise.
And really, in 5 years of interviewing creators, it sounds like, and you say 2, 5, 10 years, 20 years, it sounds like 10 is the average mm-hmm. of really having to be out there. I in the kids panel a couple hours ago, Art Balthazar, you know, was doing Patrick the Wolf Boy for over 10 years. And finally, DC came to him and said, you know, we like that. Come up with something DC-related in that style. Tiny Titans was born. Brian Bendis, who I speak to constantly, says, yeah, I was an overnight success sitting around on the Artist Alley convention world for 10 years before Marvel took a chance with him. It seems to be the average of everything. And I'm glad you said the 1,000 fans because it ties to another creative idea, and that's Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote a book called The Tipping Point. And he always says you need to put in 10,000 hours of doing something before you can really become an expert at it. And he used Michael Jordan as an example and said that it really took 10,000 hours of practicing basketball all the time before it really became second nature and you really could, you know, kind of find your groove. I know that's happened with me with interviewing. I've been doing, you know, radio interviewing for 20 years, and you go back to the first 10 years of my career and it sucked. And I, you know, and it really, I got to
know
Exactly. But no, really, I mean, I got to interview some great people, but I really didn't know what the hell I was doing. And it really took a long time before I really felt comfortable and could go in and, you know, half-ass things like I'm doing today. But let's get back to your next questions.
I was going to say, a friend of mine once told me it took her 30 years to become an overnight success.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. So, that's a great way to put it.
30 years of doing $15 paintings and things like that, and now she makes 5 digits per painting, so...
Caricatures on the boardwalk. I've heard that story a lot from artists and stuff. So, any more questions? Sir, miss?
How is writing for like a web-based audience different from like a comic book? Because there's probably some differences there, like just how like the news is different today. So, like, how do you guys think it's different in regards to audience?
I guess it's really what you're basing your webcomic for. It's your audience. There are people who do topical cartoons. I wish Julian Lytle was here because he's hysterical to have on a panel. But, you know, my comic doesn't have anything that's current events in it. But the thing that I like is I'm doing something that's an all-ages comic. And, you know, most publishing companies will not take risks on all-ages comics that are not so dumbed down, you know, that they have to be so politically correct and so drained of everything that I love about classic all-ages work. They won't touch it. So now I can do things like kill the main character's toy, and
broke my heart.
And I'm allowed to do that to create the dramatic effect that I want, you know, or something like, you know, David Peterson's Mouse Guard is a really great example, even though it's a published comic, of something that is all ages that is so successful that they're hands off on it because there's a lot of violence in that book and there's blood in that book and main characters die. But it's still an all-ages book, and there are a lot of parents that will not let their kids touch that book. And then it's little tiny mice, and they're like, no, they killed that snake. That's the attitude that a lot of people have. You know, so that's the difference between the publishing world and your world, is that you can do what you want.
Yeah, it's the freedom. You don't get any money, but you get the freedom to do what you want.
That's fair.
Folks, I'm sorry. I would love for this to continue, but we literally are at the hour. So thank you very much to the panel.
Okay, there's the bell. Class dismissed for this session of Word Balloon University. I hope you check out the webcomics we talked about today. They're all great creators, and they have very interesting and diverse styles. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Don't forget, Word Balloon University will be soon spinning off into its own podcast. So keep listening to Word Balloon for further details, and we'll let you know when classes start full force. Until then, John Sutris reminding you that this session of Word Balloon was brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Yes, they always have great selections of trade paperbacks, hardbacks, essentials, omnibus editions, absolute editions, all at reduced prices. But currently this month, there's a big sale on all products under the Project Superpowers umbrella. Now, you know I'm a big fan of Golden Age characters, and I think Alex Ross and company have done an excellent job with the Project Superpowers books being released by Dynamite Entertainment. Of course, my good friend Doug Klaba is responsible for those two-page origins you see at the back of a lot of the issues, but the trade paperbacks are available at InStockTrades.com at 50% off. The first Project Superpowers trade paperback is priced at just $9.99. Chapter 2, $4.99. Project Superpowers The Black Terror, $7.49. The Death-Defying Devil, $7.49. And Masquerade, just $7.49. All waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. And don't forget, if your orders are $50 or over, you get free shipping. Check out all the details at InStockTrades.com. John Sutris saying thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is heading to San Diego. More details as we get closer. But very excited about the coverage and events that Word Balloon will be involved with. More on that in the days and weeks ahead. Follow me on Twitter under John Word Balloon or at Facebook under my name, John Sutris. Any questions or comments about the show, you can either leave them there or via email, john@wordballoon.com. You can also start a thread at the Word Balloon message board, which you can access at our home site, wordballoon.com, or at jinxworld.com, Brian Bendis' hangout. So thanks for listening. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2010.